This is the Education Gadfly Show.
How you doing? What else do you want me to say? Thank you. What else can I say? Appreciate it. Great being here.
Still employed.
Still employed. Happy summer.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, a man who just had a golf summit with Fordham's Chester Finn, Richard Colvin.
Thanks, Michael. It's Richard Lee Colvin.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Let's get this right.
So I'd love to see that, the think tank golf summit between Ed Sector and the Thomas B. Fordham Institute.
Yeah, but you can imagine that there'd be a long time in between shots as we'd discuss things like vouchers, pro and con, and we'd even forget that we were playing golf.
Yeah, that's probably true. But see, I think there'd be a lot of camaraderie, so much that we agree upon, Richard. I mean, as some people have pointed out, it's hard to find issues.
Well, you know, I'm a middle-of-the-road guy, and I'm a middle-of-the fairway guy, so I'd just be straight down the middle, man.
Nice. I like it. Well, Richard, it's great to have you on the show. For those who don't know, Richard is the new president. Is that your title?
Executive director. I wanted president, but no. Executive director. I've got something to aspire to.
All right. Executive director. CEO? Can we call you CEO?
No.
No, not even that.
Can't.
What's up with your board? Anyways, the executive director of education sector and is in the process of moving down to Washington, D.C.
That's right. If I were selling a house in Washington, it would sell in 2 weeks like Petrilli's did.
Yep.
But now I'm up in Ridgewood, New Jersey, and the market's a little slower down there,
Yeah. Well, we got a lot to cover today. We're going to play Pardon the Gadfly. We're going to hear Amber's Research Minute. Chris's What's Up With That. So let's get started. Intern Josh is here with us today to lead us in Pardon the Gadfly.
All right. On Monday, Michigan Governor Rick Snyder announced the creation of a new recovery school district of sorts for Detroit's failing schools. Do we have any reason to believe this will cure what ails Motown?
What do you think, Richard?
Well, we don't have a really good track record of states taking over districts, let alone lots and lots of districts. I guess they're talking about the lowest 5% of schools throughout the state being taken over by the district. Look, I mean, one of their big strategies is they want to give these low-performing schools more autonomy. And autonomy cuts both ways. It can be a reward for high-performing schools. It also can be a catalyst for change, but only if you have a lot of support from the center, only if you have, support to help improve leadership, teacher quality, teachers working together, these kinds of things. You can't just let schools just go off on their own and expect them to get a lot better.
So the idea here is that very much like what Louisiana did with the Recovery School District, which, as we shall remember, was created before Hurricane Katrina. But then after the hurricane was used to scoop up most of the schools in New Orleans, most people feel like that district made a lot of progress.
Well, that's right. But there were a lot of outside players that came in to help that district, whether it's charter management organizations or other kinds of organizations. The Detroit plan hasn't talked about that. It's talked about a statewide education recovery district, in a sense. And we just got to know more details about where that support's going to come from.
You know, the former emergency manager, I guess, Robert Bob, known to his friends as Bob.
Bob.
You know, as Amber pointed out the other day, you know, he's made statements about the human capital challenge in Detroit. I mean, all of these reform plans are great, but, you know, you got to find a way to recruit top-notch people into these schools, and it's not clear that who's going to come work in Detroit right now.
That's a difficult issue in every urban city, isn't it? I mean, urban situation. And, New York's kind of figured it out. I mean, but again, then again, Manhattan's not Detroit.
Exactly. See, right? I think this is totally different, right? Yeah, if you're talking about New York, D.C., San Francisco, Chicago, places where young 20-somethings want to live and where a teaching job is, it's decent pay and good benefits for somebody in their 20s, you know. But who's going to move to Detroit after they graduate? I mean, and there are people out there, and by the way, you can get a really good deal on real estate right now if you want to do that. But I think it's going to be hard. And maybe what we need is the same kind of spirit that we had after Katrina, where a lot of young people saw this as a way to serve, as their generation's chance to do good. And we need that kind of same call for people to come to Detroit and help to rebuild the city, where things are so desolate and desperate.
Yeah, Mike, everybody who says anything negative about Detroit these days is going to get a lot of email and a lot of calls, because there really is a growing sense that Detroit can be saved, and there is a lot of young people moving there. There's foundations that are doing important work, and I think there's some hope, but it's really... I was born downriver Detroit, it's a difficult place to see. It's a difficult place to certainly live in, and it's let's hope that they can turn it around.
Richard, will you move education sector to Detroit to show your support for your hometown?
I would move there in a heartbeat, but I think my colleagues would stay behind. So
exactly.
There you go.
Exactly. Okay, topic number two.
All right. The CCSSO announced the creation of its own roadmap to accountability, which states can use as they file waivers for NCLB accountability provisions. Is this a threat to accountability or a reasonable way forward?
Well, if you look at the document, which I helped give some advice on, I'm sure among a cast of thousands, it's really hard to know what to make of it. I mean, it's very vague. I'm sure this is the kind of thing, it's a consensus document, so all the rough edges are gone. The basic idea, though, is to have the federal government require certain elements that states would have in their accountability plans, but to leave the details to the states. And this is very similar, almost exactly similar, to what Fordham has proposed. So I obviously think it's a good idea. I mean, the point here is that, look, we had the experience in No Child Left Behind of trying to micromanage state accountability systems. There was a lot of game playing as a result, some of which may have been nefarious, and some of it was a reasonable reaction from the states to ridiculous federal mandates, you know, and to sort of harebrained ideas from Hill staffers or advocacy groups that got into the law. And so, you know, to my eye, this is a time we need to allow now a new generation of experimentation around accountability. We need to let states try some different things, try to have an attitude that they are doing this, you know, for the right reasons. And, you know, if what they're proposing looks reasonable on its face, give it a try.
Well, I think you're right about that. I mean, states have to be invested in their accountability systems if they're going to really try to make them work, and if their big school districts are going to believe in them, and if it's going to catalyze them to do the right thing. You know, I'd like to see, frankly, I'm sorry I haven't read the whole thing, and maybe it's in there, but I would like to see that there's not just data on graduation rates, which I know they're calling for, but also data on the percentage of students who graduate who have to take remedial classes. Let's get some post-secondary indicators in there and use them to hold districts accountable for career and college readiness.
Now, they seem to also be kind of putting the secretary on alert that states are going to start applying for these waivers, whether the department wants them to or not. Kentucky, I guess this week was the first. What do you think? People are kind of trying to raise the stakes here around NCLB. First, Arnie Duncan to Congress saying, if you don't fix the law, I will. And now states to Arnie saying, you know, we're not going to wait for you to come out with your package of waivers and flexibility. We're going to come right at you.
You know, Mike, we all are talking about as if we're post No Child Left Behind world. We're all thinking about where it's going to go. But the reality is that AYP numbers are going to come out again in the fall, and we're living under this old law, and everybody thinks it's a mess. Of course there's pressure to move things forward and try to fix these issues. I mean, it's just hard to be out there and being held accountable for a bunch of different things, including AYP, when you know that, you know, everybody thinks that that's not the right metric.
Yet the NCLB fans, and there are at least six of them that I can count still out there, will say, look, the law is working. The achievement for poor and minority kids is going way, way up. Even on the history NAEP, we're seeing that. So what's the rush to dump this law? It's actually doing good.
Well, the rush to dump the law is that more and more schools are being identified as quote-unquote failing schools. I think when Duncan said that it was going to be over 80%, it was an exaggeration. But in a lot of states, there are an awful lot of state schools that are already being identified that way. And when you get so many schools, it's meaningless. Like any law, if it's not enforced, if it doesn't mean something and change behavior, then why even have it?
Okay, topic number three.
Last week, the NAEP history scores were released. Overall, they were flat, though we saw big increases for poor and minority students. Is this good or bad news?
Well, I saw the questions that the New York Times ran over the weekend, and there were six of them. I could answer four, so I guess I'm, you know, basic in my understanding of American history, but I've read a whole bunch of presidential biographies in the last few years, and I know a lot more than I did when I graduated from high school, so I don't know what to make of it.
Yeah, I mean, the frameworks are excellent. I mean, our reviewers at Fordham have looked at them and think they're very good. But this is tough stuff, and it's a rigorous test. The finding was that kids do worse in history than any other subject. But look, I mean, I don't know how meaningful that is. I think the point is that the history test was really hard.
Well, that was the seniors, right?
I think that's right.
Yeah. And the younger grades, they actually are doing better than they were in the past, which, you know.
What I was saying was compared to other subjects.
Compared to other subjects,
they
right.
They do worse in history than in other subjects. But right. Yes, there's some huge progress being made, especially for poor minority and low achieving kids.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, it gets conflated with whether we're doing a better job on reading. Maybe that's what's happening with the improved scores. But you're right. There are huge huge gaps, and I guess there's reason to be concerned that we're paying so much attention to basic skills that we're not delivering content around the history standards. But I don't know. I'm not sure how upset about it to be, given that, like I say, I mean, most American adults couldn't answer those questions.
And so you could. I mean, look. I mean, I think I look at this and I say this could definitely have been a good news story if you look at the numbers for poor and minority kids. And for the lowest achieving kids, I mean, huge gain since 15 years ago. They basically know a year's more history than they did before. This is significant, and yet, you know, those of us in the chattering class and the reporters don't like to run with the positive news line.
Yeah, but it's always easy to say kids don't know anything about history. You know, it's and we laugh. It's a laugh line, right? You know, don't know much about history. The thing is that it really, really matters, you know? I mean, some of the debates today in our politics really go back to our founding. Centralization, decentralization, public, private, nullifications, you know, these are important issues. But I think, you know, knowing about history is an ongoing process. You can't just learn it once when you're in 12th grade and then, you know, say, I know it.
Okay, that's all the time we've got for Pardon the Gadfly. Thank you, Richard, for playing, and Josh for asking those questions. It's now time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much. Hi, how you doing? What else you want me to say? Thank you. What else can I say? Appreciate it. Great being here.
Still employed.
Still employed. Happy summer.
That's right. Happy summer. I feel like we've had summer for like
yesterday was
now.
The last first day of summer.
First day. Longest day. It was still light out at 8:45. I was out watering my plants at 8:45 thinking, wow, I can still see.
Yeah. Cool. You know, one of the coolest things I've ever gotten to do is to be in Alaska for the summer solstice. Something you should try to do someday. Actually ran a marathon on that day.
Wow. Yeah. I'm impressed.
The summer solstice marathon, the one marathon I've ever done.
Did you need all that light just to finish it?
Yeah, exactly. That was a good thing. You had all day and all night to finish it.
That's great.
Okay, Amber, what you got for us this week?
So this week I'm going to do a little promo on Fordham's newest report called Charting a New Course to Retirement, How Charter Schools Handle Teacher Pensions. A lot of C's in that title. Sorry about that. Between 2004 and 2010, a little factoid here, district pension costs, not including retirement help. Let me start over. Bleh. Let me start over. Okay. This week I'm doing a little promo on Fordham's new report called Charting a New Course to Retirement, How Charter Schools Handle Teacher Pensions. So first a factoid, between 2004 and 2010, district pension costs, that would be not including retiree health insurance, which is actually important, increased from 12% to 15% of salaries. So naturally folks think, hey, that figure is going to keep rising. But what about teachers who are employed by charter schools that are not required to participate in state teacher pension plans? So we asked this question to Mike Podgursky and Amanda Olberg. They examined data from 6 charter-heavy states out of 16 that are allowed to opt out. Those 6 states, Arizona, California, Florida, Louisiana, Michigan, and New York, contain about 3/4 of the schools eligible for the study. They found that participation rates varied greatly among them, from over 90% in California to 23% in Florida.
Well, the participation in the traditional state retirement
that's right.
plans?
Yep.
Okay.
One thing that apparently affected participation is whether or not teachers in the state participate in Social Security, which gets kind of complicated. We can talk about that in a minute. In California and Louisiana, for instance, charter schools that participate in the state retirement system need not participate in Social Security, which creates an incentive for charter schools to opt into their state retirement system. Another little quick point, analysts also took a random 20% sample of opt-out schools and surveyed them to see if they offered an alternative. The most common alternatives were 401ks and 403bs. 77% of the sample offered a pension plan containing an employer contribution, with a majority favoring a dollar-for-dollar match. However, 14% of the schools not participating in the state plan offered no plan. 9% offered a plan with no employer contribution. So, in short, lots of the alternatives appear less expensive and a little more flexible than the state system, but there's lots more work to be done.
So, first of all, it's interesting that charter schools, when given a chance, they do personnel differently. We already knew from a previous Podgorski study that they go at things like merit pay and differentiated compensation in a variety of ways. They do take the opportunity to do those things. Now we know that they make different decisions around pensions. I do believe that some charter school critics are probably going to have some fun with the finding that 23% of these charter schools give their teachers not a dime for retirement.
Well, you got to think about what kind of people you're going to get. Any of these benefit systems has a set of incentives that are going to bring you a different kind of person. So, you know, maybe you want young teachers who don't plan to stay there very long and who, you know, think teaching for a little bit is fine, and then they'll move on to someplace that has real benefits and, you know, be a real professional. But I just can't see any place that's trying to hire professionals just not offering any kind of retirement at all. It's just not a good thing to do if you want the best people.
You know, Rick Kahlenberg, who is at the Century Fund, we gave him the study a few days in advance, as we did a couple other bloggers, and he wrote a piece really hitting charters hard on this point. And he said that, you know, basically they're not living up to this basic social contract that we have in this country, that we expect employers to provide pensions. I mean, is that still the case? Is that social contract still? I mean, do people look at a small business or other places that don't give pension plans and say that they are acting immorally or unethically?
Yeah, I think so. And we had a group of charter pension advocates and operators in for the meeting before we prepared this report. And many said, you know what, even when we offer a matching, teachers don't take it. We're literally calling them and saying, hey, guess what? Participate in this. And, you know,
we'll match you.
Well, but that's true. Defined benefit or defined contribution plans, it's true throughout all the sectors that there's low participation. And one of the things that this administration has done is to make it a, you have to opt out, that if your company offers a 401k plan, it's assumed that you are going to participate. It doesn't mean that you have to contribute over and above the minimum to to get the benefits and the company contribution. But people make all sorts of stupid financial decisions, and I'm not sure that that's due to exercising freedom as much as it is to just not understanding what their options are.
So the other thing that this study made more clear to me, and it is complicated, is this Social Security question, that there are a number of states where public employees, including teachers, are not in Social Security. And so when you have some states, this was like in Illinois, where they say, okay, we're going to solve our pension problem by slashing benefits for future teachers. You could have a situation where people, you know, 23-year-old could be teaching in Illinois, you know, planning to get a very small pension for teaching and not getting Social Security. I mean, those people are screwed. Warning, don't go teach in that state because you're never going to be able to retire. I mean, this is, you know, and the one obvious solution, and the unions, I guess, historically have been against this, but is to get everybody into Social Security. It's a kind of historical anomaly that we've got some of these public employees out of Social Security.
But we know that Social Security is not going to give you your full, you know, you're not going to live like you do when you work if you just get Social Security. Thing is that we can design pension systems to set up a lot of different kinds of incentives. The way they are now, it doesn't really work because you've got to be teaching 25, 30 years before you get a big bump up in pensions. And if you change how that works and are very strategic about how it's going to help you attract the best teachers, across all the experience, you know, you want not just young teachers, you want some teachers who have shown their chops and are really experienced and can help the others and mentor them. So you got to be very careful about how you define these benefit plans. And just saying we're going to save money by not offering one, I don't think it's a smart way to go. But
all right, Amber, what song goes along with this one? And I hope it is tightly connected.
All right. Well, it's not too
tight, loose, tight, loose.
Not a hard stretch on this one. Since we're talking about retirement, we have Old Man by Neil Young.
Ooh, Neil Young.
24 and there's so much more. Live alone in a paradise that makes me think of two. love lost such a cost. Give me things that don't get lost, like a coin that won't get tossed, rolling home to you.
I love that song by Neil Young.
Old man, take a look at yourself. You're a lot like me.
Oh, yes. Do you and Peter Cunningham from Arnie Duncan's staff go out and jam sometimes?
No.
Rock legends.
No.
But I tell you, when I saw Neil Young last time, I was the old guy who thought it was too loud, and I left early, and they said the encores were the best.
Yeah.
So I'm too old.
All right. It's now time for Chris Irvine's What's Up With That?
This morning and I got out of bed, had a big old cup of coffee to clear my head. Telephone rang and you wanna chat? Well, sit on down and tell me what up with that. What up with that? Yes,
sir. Chris, welcome back to the show.
How's it going, Mike?
Chris, I understand that your car got towed this morning.
Yes, it did. Much thanks to the K Street Northeast rush hour.
So I'm impressed that you were able to find it and drive it pretty quickly. You did not get stuck in some huge bureaucratic morass in D.C.
Well, thank God I didn't have to deal with anyone in the DMV. They just towed the car literally a block and a half around the street and put it in a different spot. You know, slapped a nice $200 ticket on my windshield and let me on my way. So
should have had him tow it to your parking space.
Well, problem is I don't have a parking space.
Oh, that's
so.
A problem. Back to the
why I got towed in the first place.
That's right, exactly. Well, I'm glad that you were able to make it in time for the show, Chris.
Glad to be here.
All right, so what are we talking about this week?
Well, this week's object of my curiosity comes from across the pond, where UK news outfit The Telegraph reports that two male students have been reprimanded for playing an army game at school. My mind began racing immediately upon reading the headline, picturing images of teenage students recklessly hurling dangerous projectiles at one another with little regard to those caught in the crossfire. Come to find out, the two instigators being chastised are not high schoolers, but rather seven-year-old boys merely playing a game comparable to cops and robbers or Indians and cowboys. No weapons were actually branded or objects actually launched. The boys were simply making pistol shapes with their fingers.
Oh my.
What's up with that?
Wow.
The school, deeming the game as unacceptable behavior, has gone on record to defend their reaction by stating that threatening behavior will not be tolerated and that the boys should appropriately be reprimanded. I understand the severity of gun violence and the issues in schools that have arisen in the past because of it. But seven-year-old boys playing a harmless, not to mention centuries-old game at recess, how is that punishable? It's not as if these kids will suddenly think, you know, this game is so fun that we should up the ante and bring in real guns. Once again, we have ourselves another case of excessive political correctness, and in my opinion, it's deplorable. Not surprisingly, while government inspectors rated the school as good overall last year, they warned that children ought to have greater freedom to play. I guess we just have to accept that the day has finally come when schools are restricting students' imaginations.
So I saw the story this week, and I told my wife about it because she relayed a story to me about our son from yesterday, that he was at the library with a friend of his. They are both three. And sure enough, they were making that pistol shape with their hands, and they were pretending to shoot other children as they were coming into the library. Now, my wife was, this is kind of a phase, the three-year-old gun phase, and, you know, especially living in the People's Republic of Tacoma Park, a nuclear-free zone, you know, we have some, strong feelings that we would not like him to pretend to play guns. But that my wife especially noted that the two of them were a little reminiscent of the guys that shot up Columbine. And this was very disturbing to her as a parent that, like, what am I need to stop this now because 15 years from now, who knows what could happen.
You want to keep kids safe, but you know, you also have to let them play, and there's a balance there, right? Any parent knows that if you let kids just run wild and crazy and do dangerous things, it may be freedom, but it's dangerous. So it's how do you set the right limits?
But this isn't even dangerous. I mean, what if they
I'm just saying that this is the central issue, right?
I mean, what if they play cowboys and Indians? And it's, a, you know, the Indian is not a, you know, historically accurate portrayal of Native Americans, but instead is, you know, the good old-fashioned... I mean, in that case, I mean, as a parent or a teacher, do you step in and correct and say, no, no, that's an ugly stereotype that we don't want to, you know, continue? Or do you say, again, well, they're kids, this is a game people have played for 300 years.
But of course, today the war is played on screen, right? I mean, the video games are incredibly violent, so... I'm a lot less worried about kids running around and sticking their fingers in each other.
That's right. I mean, regardless of whatever hand gestures they're using, if they're outside on the playground, I think we should be forced.
That's right.
That's where I'm coming from.
All right, that's where you're coming from. All right, well, that is all the time we have for this week. Richard, thanks so much for being an excellent guest host.
It was fun. Thanks, Michael.
Hope you'll come back now that you're local.
Just down the block.
All righty. Till next week.
I'm Richard Colvin from Education Sector. Thanks very much, Michael.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Education Gadfly Show, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.